This talk is by way of a declaration of independence from the tyranny of the Temple Bulletin. The bulletin, as you know, comes out biweekly. Material for the bulletin needs to be in 4 to 5 weeks ahead of time. I therefore have to pick topics considerably in advance. In the past, when the subject I've chosen has become passé, no longer interesting to me, I persevered, but no longer. The topic of this morning was to have been, for all these things, let us give thanks. Among the things I am grateful for is I'm not going to talk to you on that subject. Rather, I'm instead going to begin an intermittent series on the four holy cities in Israel. Why the change? Because it interests me, because I believe it can tell us a good deal about our times and our history. First of all, what is a holy city? The term is early medieval. It describes a city famous for its wonder-working graves, the graves of well-known and revered ancestors. There are four such towns in Palestine: Hebron, Jerusalem, Tzfat, and Tiberias. In Hebron, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah are buried, or presumed to be. In Jerusalem, King David. In Tzfat, Rabbis Meir, Akiba, and Maimonides, as well as many others. In Tiberias, Hillel and Shammai, and Shimeon Bar Yochai. Now, this does not mean that these men and women were actually buried in these places. Maimonides, we know, was buried in Egypt. But tradition associated with places, these places with the illustrious dead, and piety associated these graves with faith healing and with intercessory prayer. So these places became places of pilgrimage, of healing, of prayer for the early coming of the Messiah, for the restoration of Israel's independence. And let me begin by reminding you of those wonderful bejeweled caskets called reliquaries, which you can see and admire in our better museums. They were designed to hold the bones of some martyr or a lock of hair of some saint. To read the Christian chronicles of the Middle Ages is to realize how important these reliquaries were. No self-respecting church or cathedral could be without one. All kinds of miracle stories were associated with them. How a thief broke into a cathedral treasury, stole a reliquary, only to have God strike him down with a thunderbolt. Faithful looked upon these relics as tangible proof that there was something divine in the precincts of the building or in the design of their faith. This kind of belief was not limited to Christianity. If you travel in Buddhist Asia, you'll find at every great shrine a stone pile called a stupa. Inside the heart of each stupa, there's a little box in which are preserved some things associated with the Buddha: a lock of hair, tooth, or something associated with one of the bodhisattvas, one of the Buddhist saints. The same reasons are put forward as in Christianity. The presence of a relic of the saint enhances the power of prayer. Now, because Islam, like Judaism, believes in the resurrection of the body, parts of their holy men's bodies were not available for these reliquaries. Still, the same psychological mechanisms operated in Muslim and Jewish worlds as well. Throughout North Africa and the Middle East, there are hundreds of little grave shrines, usually a simple mound or brick building. The grave is raised above ground. Beside it, you will find the faithful have placed small stones, each stone representing a particular prayer for healing, for safety in childbirth, for the dying or the dead. One of the interesting things about these graves is that local Muslims and Jews participate in the worship of the saint or the holy man, no matter of what faith he was. In Hebron, for instance, you will find Muslims, Christians, and Jews worshiping in a single shrine, the Machpelah, devoted to Abraham and Sarah and their ancestors. Of course, there have always been rationalists and skeptics who mock at all this talk of holy graves, reliquaries, and faith. There's a story that you can find in innumerable places in Arab folklore. An Arab man, down on his luck, nothing left but his donkey. And his donkey left for Damascus to try one last time to make their fortune in the world. Things went from bad to worse, and finally the Arab could not even provide fodder for the donkey. The animal died. He buried the donkey and lay above his grave in a prostration of grief. caravan happened to be passing along the same route. They saw the Arab prostrate on the ground praying and thought, aha, here is a holy grave. Let's not pass on without doing our duty. They came and they prayed. And of course, when you pray, you leave a few dollars for the man who manages a shrine. And soon the Arab had a flourishing business at the grave of his donkey. Lest you feel such credulity is for them and not for us, let me assure you that visiting the graves of holy men has been one of the most common religious traditions of our people for more than 2,000 years. Some years ago, our family was in Morocco. We drove up to the Atlas Mountains from Marrakesh. Along the road, we came across a small domed building with a mug in David above the door. We got out and came closer so I could read the sign on the side of the building. It said in Hebrew and Arabic, "This is the grave of the holy man, Rebbe so-and-so." We went inside, and I read the inscription on the tombstone. It was the grave of a man who had lived in the neighborhood and who had died fairly recently, a man who had some kind of reputation for faith healing. Candles lit by the faithful were guttering in front of the tomb. I was told by the keeper, a Muslim, that Muslim and Jews from the countryside often came to this place to offer their prayers. It mattered not that the saint was a Jew. What was important was that he was a holy man. Those who came sometimes brought a written petition. It was their hope that the intercession of this holy man would permit their prayers to be sped into heaven, to be heard there by God. I propose to speak first in this new series about Hebron, because Hebron contains the graves that claim to be the oldest. The very old title for Hebron was Kiryat Arba, the place of the four, a title which later biblical piety interpreted to refer to those four couples whose graves presumably exist in Hebron: Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah, and believe it or not, Adam and Eve. When the association of these particular grave sites with the patriarchs was first made, it can no longer be recalled. The association with Adam and Eve shows how implausible these identifications are. But lack of plausibility has never been a drawback to personal faith. The belief of Jews, Christians, and Muslims has been for more than 2,000 years that these were actually the graves of the patriarchs, and that was enough. The Bible makes quite a point of the fact that Abraham spent a great deal of time in and around Hebron. He pitched his tents near the Terebinth of Mamre, a great oak tree under which he sat when visitors came by. And if you're particularly gullible, your guide will still point out to you Abraham's tree. The Bible is quite specific that the Machpelah, the cave that Abraham secured for the grave of his wife Sarah, was in Hebron. But that, of course, is only an ancient claim. There's no reason to accept it as certain evidence. What is true is that there are a number of graves in the present Machpelah compound inside a large Herodian wall which encloses a Crusader church, which supposedly house the graves of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. Great medieval arch canopies cover the graves, which are the object of veneration by the Orthodox pious of all the Western traditions. And what we know about Hebron is that it was captured from the Canaanites by King David about 8 years before he captured Jerusalem, and served as the capital of his kingdom until David centered his authority in Jerusalem. Hebron then remained in Judean hands for several hundred years until the Babylonian exile, when it was depopulated of its Jewish elite and taken over by the Edomites, a group of people from the area of modern Jordan. Hebron remained Edomite for about four centuries until the second century BCE, when the city was captured by the Hasmoneans, the descendants of Judah the Maccabee, our Hanukkah story. Then the floor of the Machpelah was covered over, and a great wall was built, which is known as the Wall of Herod, although it may have been built slightly before his time. The historian Josephus, towards the end of the first century, indicates that these venerated graves had great marble forms towering over them. Hebron was not destined ever to become a major town. It was, and remains, a small market city on the southern end of the commercial route, which runs across the top of the Judean hills, from the Negev through Bethlehem and Jerusalem to Samaria and the Galil. There are, of course, advantages in being a remote and second-tier town. Hebron doesn't seem to have suffered as badly as Jerusalem did during the Jewish revolts against Rome. It was and remained largely a holy place where people came to pray. When the Byzantines took over that part of the world, a Greek church was built above the ancestors' grave. In the middle of the 7th century, Muslims took over from the Byzantines and converted the church into a mosque, which they called the Haram al-Khalil, the Mosque of a Good Friend, a name which Abraham bears often in the Quran. Over the next half millennium, it is from about the middle of the 7th century to the middle of the 12th century, Jews and Muslims coexisted in Hebron. The Jews were a definite minority, but they managed to remain and to worship near the shrine. A tradition of post-biblical literature has it that burial in Hebron near the graves is even more efficacious than burial on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. On the day of judgment, if you're buried there, you'll be resurrected first. With the arrival of the Crusaders in the early 12th century, conditions for Jews changed for the worse. The Crusaders killed most of the Jews of Hebron. When the Muslims reasserted their authority a century and a half later, they placed all kinds of restrictions on the entry to the Machpelah. In the year 1266, the Muslim leaders passed a law that no Jew could come into the Haram, the closed area where the graves were. Jews could not go beyond the 7th step of a nearby passageway. A window was cut near the 4th step, which led down to a shaft which fell to the grave level. The Jews would come to the 4th step, take their little prayer shawl, utter a prayer, perhaps write it on a scrap of paper, and drop it through the window so it would fall to the grave site. But that was it. From 1266 to 1967, when the West Bank fell to Israel, no Jew was able to come closer to the graves of the patriarchs than these steps on the east side of the Machpelah. In the 14th and 15th century, a ghetto developed in Hebron. Jews built this walled area for their own protection. During this period, some 50 extended families survived and managed to live within a distinguishable area. Their business, largely managing the Jewish pilgrims who came to Hebron to offer their prayers. There's a little inn where Jews could stay when they were in Hebron. And the centerpiece of Hebron's ghetto was a synagogue known as Beit Knesset Avraham Avinu, synagogue of Abraham, our father. Again and again and again, the association of Hebron and Abraham. The long medieval midnight of the Jews of Hebron did not end with the coming of the 19th and 20th centuries. By and large, Hebron was overlooked by the more modern Jewish pioneers. There's very little arable land around Hebron. Hebron had never been, was not destined to be, an industrial city. It remains a small market town, which deals with heavy Venetian-looking glass and other trinkets for tourists. Hebron was and is a center of what we call the Old Yeshuv, that is of those who came to Palestine to hasten through prayer the coming of the Messiah, not of those who came to Palestine to build with their own hands a modern Jewish state. And this fact, too, has complicated Hebron's problems. In the middle of the 19th century, true to its destiny, Hebron was settled by the disciples of the Chabad movement, Hasidic Jews from Eastern Europe. Around 1850, the Chabad established their own yeshiva and center in Hebron. Then in the early decades of the 20th century, a great yeshiva, Lithuanian yeshiva, Slobodka, established in Hebron a center for young Jews who wanted to come to live there in piety, study the Talmud, and pray for the Messiah. Now, Hebron is the most religious of all the cities of Palestine, from either a Muslim or a Jewish point of view. It is the one Muslim city in the West Bank which still has no cinema. It remains the one city in the West Bank where most Arab women still wear the veil, and where you'd be hard put to get a hard drink at a local inn. This city, then, is one where the religious past remains very much alive, and therefore, as you might expect, the old memories and indignations are flashpoints between Muslims and Jews. Hebron was destined to have a modern martyrology as well as an ancient one. It suffered some of the first Arab attacks on the yeshuv. In 1929, the yeshiva in Hebron was attacked. The British constabulary failed to come to its defense. Before the dust had settled, 57 yeshiva students and teachers were dead. 60 more were seriously injured, in the greatest bloodletting of the pre-war World War II period in all of the yeshuv, all of Jewish Palestine. After this, the British evacuated most of the yeshiva students. But there was further unrest in 1935, which led the British to evacuate all Jews from Hebron. So Hebron remained Judenrein, free of Jews, until 1967, when King Hussein made one of his classic mistakes and, against the advice of the Israelis, entered into a war against them. Hebron fell, and so did all of the West Bank. With the fall of Hebron, there emerged a very real problem of piety and religion. The central religious memorial, the Machpelah, the gravesite of the patriarchs and matriarchs, was a sacred area which Jews had not been allowed to enter until early in the 13th century. Here was a city which had been entirely without Jews since 1935. It was now occupied by, of all things, Israel Defense Forces. The Labor government did negotiate equal times for prayer and access to the Machpelah for Jews and for Muslims. But what of the future of Hebron? There was indecision. The government did build a security enclave, which is called by the old name of Hebron, Kiryat Arba, above Hebron. The military was in residence there. But there were groups in Israel which were not satisfied with a purely military presence. Hebron reaches back, after all, to the earliest biblical times, to Abraham. It seemed to be the perfect location for making the political point. The return of the West Bank would mean a return to Muslim domination, one of the most venerable cities in Jewish history. So in 1967, a group of Jews simply moved into Hebron. Most of them were traditional Jews. Some were Jews who were determined that Israel must never again allow any part of the Holy Land to fall into non-Jewish hands. These were the Gush Emunim, and they were under the leadership of a man named Moses Lovinger. Lovinger booked a suite of rooms in the tourist hotel in the old part of Hebron called the Park Hotel, the old building in the center of town which has been the heart of the old Jewish ghetto. He and his family supposedly came for a visit, but they stayed, and they stayed. The mayor of Hebron was indignant. For him, Hebron, the old Hebron, was a purely Arab town. Arab gave speeches of condemnation at the United Nations. The Israeli government complained about those Jews who had taken the law into their own hands. But at the same time, most Israelis were not willing to see Hebron revert to its earlier Judenrein status. A deal was struck. The Lovinger group and their extended families would pull out of the Park Hotel and would be settled in Kiryat Arba. Kiryat Arba would be enlarged to include dwellings for some 3,000 citizens. Now, the government believed that the Lovinger group would stay in Kiryat Arba and time would get tired of all of this and leave. But these were fanatics, determined people. They took advantage of the new construction to turn Kiryat Arba into a major apartment city. If you go to Hebron today, you'll find that Kiryat Arba has 1,000 units, separated from Hebron by a wadi, a dry riverbed, searchlights, and a high wire fence. But Moses Lovinger was not satisfied with Kiryat Arba. He wanted a Jewish presence in Hebron. What he demanded was the old Jewish quarter, particularly the synagogue of Abraham Avinu. So one day in 1979, some women and children from Rabbi Lovinger's group descended from Kiryat Arba and began to squat in the old Jewish quarter of Hebron in an abandoned building, the defunct Beit Hadassah, an old medical clinic Hadassah had established in 1906. Now there was a Likud government in power. Mr. Begin talked about the political undesirability of their acts, but again, no one moved against them. Israel Defense Forces position was the army existed to defend Jews against Arab attack rather than remove Jews from one place to another. And so the squatters remained. Finally, in late 1980, the men came down to Beit Hadassah and joined their women folk there. They claimed they came by right. For them, this was originally Jewish land under Jewish ownership. They said, "We have every right to be here." Again, governmental indecision. Again, international complaint. Again, nothing was really done about Lovinger and his squatters. But later in 1980, tragedy struck again. A group of Jewish students and others returning from prayers were attacked by Arabs, and 6 were killed. One who was attacked was a rough, tough Jew known to have broken into Arab homes and terrorized Arab owners. The attack, however, was coordinated by the PLO and had been known ahead of time to the mayor of Hebron. The Israel government's response was to exile the mayor to try to pick up the pieces. Tensions rose to a fever pitch, and for a time, there was nothing but confrontation. The Jews who settled in Hebron claimed that it was in Hebron that God had covenanted with Abraham for the land. They claimed that it was right of Jews to live anywhere in that part of the world. The Gush further claimed that this area, the old Jewish quarter of Hebron, had been Jewish since time immemorial, that it was intolerable for the Jews to accept the proposition that any part of the Holy Land, all of which was theirs by divine right, should or could be denied them. Here in microcosm, you have the problem of the West Bank. You have all the reasons that reasonable solutions will simply not work out. There are Levengers on our side and Levengers on their side. There are reasons and there are emotions. It's one thing for negotiators to sit in Paris, London, or Washington and say, let's work out a solution. Negotiators might believe it is reasonable to argue that the West Bank would return to the Arabs in return for a guarantee of the integrity and safety of the Jewish state. But what is reasonable is not always historically feasible. And that is one of the truths that the history of Hebron makes clear. Hebron remains today largely an Arab town. It is a clannish town. It's a hard town to visit. If you're touring Israel, you'll often find Hebron scrubbed from the day's itinerary. There's too much unrest to chance a visit. Kiryat Arba and Hebron coexist across a few hundred yards, but across thousands of yards of barbed wire and searchlights. They coexist, but they do not commingle. Can you imagine the Arabs of Hebron, accustomed to no Jews for a good part of the century, be willing to allow Jews to come back, establish a thriving community in and around the old ghetto, which is now a thriving Arab marketplace for steel, primarily for the tourists? I remember visiting Hebron some 20 years ago, in the summer of 1967, just after the West Bank came to Israel's possession. Two of us took a jeep. My friend was a faculty member from the Hebrew Union College. On the way to Hebron, we had joked about the credulities of people, even of Jews. How could anyone believe that the Machpelah contained the actual graves of the patriarchs? We were separated when we entered the Machpelah. The next thing I noticed was that my well-educated, even erudite friend was standing in front of the grave of Abraham and offering there his prayers. We are creatures of the senses. One can make the argument that modern Judaism, liberal Judaism, is too antiseptic and too academic. It relies too much on the mind. I'm not arguing that we ought to begin burying our great religious heroes beneath the floors of a synagogue, or that we turn Mayfield Cemetery into a tourist attraction. I am suggesting that when the Torah is paraded around the traditional synagogue, people reach out to touch it with the corner of their tallit, and then touch the tallit to their lips. That simple religious act of touching something divine and holy seems worth more than all the brilliant readings and chantings of the Torah. A simple act of confirmation is often all that's needed to satisfy the religious needs. We need to appeal to the senses, to the eye, to the ear, the sense of touch, far more, I'm afraid, than most segments of liberal Judaism have done. The power of simple faith must never be denigrated. Reasonableness is not the final judgment that we make on matters of belief. Beliefs cannot be dictated, nor can they be overridden by sweet reason. The problem of Hebron today, and the West Bank generally, is that one can envisage solutions, but they do not take into consideration the emotions in people's minds and hearts. Amen.
Amen.